A Mr. Edgar Youngquist of Omaha, Nebraska writes, "Hey guys, I love the show, but I must say Dan's shows are not as good as they used to be. Why doesn't he do more shows like show number 62? Well, thanks for asking, Mr. Youngquist. There's no question that Dan is a shadow of his former self, but the decline started with the second episode, and he's been sliding downhill ever since. In fact, if things continue at the current pace, in 2 years, Mr. Youngquist, he'll have no options left but to become a member of the old media again. Until that time, enjoy the ride straight downhill." Dan Carlin.
Look at you. Why don't you do something with your life? You sit around here all day. You contribute nothing to society.
You're just so irritating and likable.
Oh, I have to work on that, I guess.
See, there you go, being all likable again.
Challenging audiences with big words spoken rapidly since 1994.
Well, we're real big fans of y'all.
Huge fans. You guys are almost as good as the Monkees. You guys are great.
It's Common Sense with Dan Carlin. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the show. My name is Dan Carlin, and this is Common Sense. We are your independent alternative to the partisan voices you normally hear. A ton going on today, everyone. Glad you got a hold of the program, however you may have found it. Make sure other people around you know what you're listening to. We have a jam-packed show on tap for you again today. We are, by the way, almost live from the end of Runway 2 here at the Emerald International Airport. And as I said, a loaded program. For example, coming up a little bit later on in the show, we're going to have another edition of Riffin' on the News, that segment where we throw in a bunch of news stories and don't go into too much depth, but we have more news stories than we know what to do with, so we have to have another Riffin' on the News segment. That'll be coming up a little bit later on in the program. But before we go there, I have one of these topics that I've been sitting around trying to figure out some sort of an analogy for, something I could bring up to you that I think is in some ways similar to what I want to talk about today, give you an idea of how I think about it. And this is, by the way, a controversial subject, needless to say. So here's the way I thought I might approach it. I thought I might approach it by pointing out that there's a guy serving a life sentence here in the United States in a prison. He was originally sentenced to death, but he was saved because in the early 1970s, the Supreme Court struck down the death penalty, and anyone who was on death row at the time received a reprieve. They received life imprisonment instead. This guy's name is Charles Manson. You've probably heard of Charles Manson. You may not know the specifics of the Manson case, but you've probably heard of Charles Manson. Manson is one of the most captivating murder figures in American history. Murder figure being a good word, because, you see, one of the interesting things about Charles Manson is that, at least in a court of law via convictions, Manson never murdered anyone. Charles Manson was sentenced to death for the deaths of, well, at least like 7 or 8 people that he never actually killed. Well, I guess that depends, doesn't it? You see, Charles Manson was convicted of having other people kill people for him. That's not even quite right. You see, Manson was, called a cult leader in the late 60s. A hippie cult leader was the way he was referred to. And Manson had all these younger people who were, for lack of a better word, disciples. People that would do whatever Manson said. At least this is the way the court case unfolded. Now, Manson was convicted and sentenced to death because the jury came to the conclusion that even though Manson didn't do any of the killings that he was on trial for, those killings would not have happened had he not, basically, told his followers to go do that. In other words, he had people acting for him. And so these events unfolded the way they did because it was his will that they did. You can go to, go online, go to a place like YouTube and type in Charles Manson, and you'll see a bunch of interviews that have been done with him over the years. And one thing that Manson will say over and over and over again is, "I didn't kill anybody." But it's pretty plain that those people would be alive today if Manson hadn't basically told other people to go do it. Now, here's why I brought that up, and I know this is a tenuous connection maybe to you. There is a trial going on right now in Italy. The trial involves the case of a man, a radical, what we would call here, a radical Egyptian cleric. The guy's name is Abu Omar. Now, what happened to Abu Omar, allegedly, was that he was kidnapped from the streets of Milan 5 years ago. taken to Egypt by CIA agents. This is what he says. And there, tortured by Egyptian authorities as part of the extreme rendition program that the U.S. is involved in. His wife testified on Wednesday, I believe it was May 14th, 2008, that her husband was shocked with electrical shocks all over his body, his genitals. Typical modern torture techniques, I guess you could say. And in Italy, they're trying to decide whether or not 26 Americans, most of them CIA operatives, will go to jail or stand, you know, be in trouble for this. Now, there are so many angles on this I want to touch on. I don't know where to start. But the first thing I want to touch on is that the CIA operatives that they're looking at in Italy as part of the problem here are about as guilty of anything as Manson's followers were. None of these people decided on their own that they were going to kidnap this guy, if they did. And none of these people decided that Egypt would be the place we would take them. None of them decided the specific tortures that would be done in Egypt. These people are like Manson's followers in terms of culpability. Now, maybe you would use the Nuremberg trial idea and say that, hey, you know, just because someone told you to do it doesn't get you off the hook. But we all know what program, as much as we know about this program, those people were operating under. We have a policy in this country that certain people can be flown to places where they do torture. They can be tortured there, and then any information that is gleaned from the torture can be, you know, related back to us. In other words, we don't do the torturing, but we're friends with the people who do. We give money to them, and they'll torture for us and give us any info they get from the torturing. Now, somehow this is seen as detaching us from the responsibility of the act somehow. And if you don't think that's the case, let me ask you this. Why don't we torture him here? If we really want info from this radical Egyptian cleric, why didn't we fly him to Kansas, build a giant center there where we torture people? Well, because that would be wrong. Of course it would be wrong. It would be un-American and wrong. We don't have any facilities here that specialize in torture. We don't have the equivalent of the Lubyanka prison that they have in Moscow that was the famous place where the KGB did their torturing and killing. Not that kind of country. No, but we will fly you to a country that is that kind of country and get any information out of you we can. I mean, folks, look, let me back up a minute. You, if you've listened to this program for any period of time, know that I am a believer in myths. And the biggest myth that I buy into is the greatness of this country. Now, I'm not saying the country isn't great, but the myths that I buy into are all the reasons this country is great. This country's great because we don't do a lot of the things other countries do, right? We don't torture people, among other things. We believe in freedom and human rights and the progress of humankind towards a better end. The United States is, what did Ronald Reagan call us, Ben? The last best hope of man. Actually, I think that's just a quote Reagan used. But my point is, ladies and gentlemen, that I buy into that too. That's an ideal. That's a myth. But it's an ideal worth living up to, isn't it? And the only way you're going to have that myth be anything close to reality is to try to live up to it. You don't have to look at American history too deeply to realize how often we've fallen short of the mythical bar. Slavery is a perfect example of our history that sort of flies right in the face of how we perceive ourselves, right? We're for human rights, and those African Americans can have 3/5 of those. The way we treated the Native Americans. There's a lot of stuff. I mean, just look at the way we treated the Japanese Americans in the Second World War. This always makes me laugh a little, not to be funny, but when we apologize to the Japanese Americans and we try to make restitution and we talk about how bad we felt and how stupid we were back in the, you know, World War II days to be so afraid of our own citizens, and we have this idea that, you know, never again will this happen, and boy, it was a paranoid time, and can you believe our grandparents actually did that? I got news for you, ladies and gentlemen. This extreme rendition, this torturing by proxy that we do, don't you think our grandchildren are going to see that at least as bad as the internment of the Japanese in World War II? I talk to people all the time, say, can you believe how, you know, Paleolithic we were just a generation or two ago? Yeah, we're like that now. And I always say, don't judge your grandparents. It's very hard to judge people from another time without you know, walking a mile in their moccasins, as we said in one of the history shows. But you're walking a mile in their moccasins right now. We're in a war. People start getting kooky in a war. We'll lock up Japanese Americans if we're fighting the Japanese, and we'll torture people for information if we think that will help save American lives. Ladies and gentlemen, my belief in the myth of America makes a belief in torture impossible as any sort of a real tool for policy. And I don't want to get into a couple of things, because I think these are red herrings. I don't want to get into those people that say, well, Dan, it's useless anyway, because torture doesn't, you know, tell you anything. Because obviously the people that torture don't believe that. Doesn't matter. Then there's the other side of the coin that says, we're only torturing the bad guys, Dan. And it doesn't matter. I mean, do you really feel like someone like Osama bin Laden should be getting your crocodile tears? Well, I always say the same thing, folks. Would you torture him? You ever tortured anyone? You ever read accounts of torture? There are some very good accounts you can read. See, the United States hasn't been living up to the myth on the whole torture thing for a long time. You can go look at the records of U.S. policy during the Cold War, and this may come as a shock to some of you, but this idea of extreme rendition is something we've been doing for a while in this country, and we did it during the Cold War. What we didn't do is actively participate the way we are. We didn't have you seen those pictures, by the way, of us taking people from, you know, some of these terror suspects from one place to another in these aircraft, and they're hooded and they're tied down 50 different ways. That's the difference between, you know, now and then. But 25 years ago, what we were doing is calling up these governments in, say, Central and South America and saying, hey, we have a list of all these radical leftists in your country. And we give it to them, and then all of a sudden they're throwing radical leftists out the doors of airplanes over the ocean. So we've been doing this for a while. There's a plausible deniability aspect that we always buy into, though. There's something about letting the other country do the torturing that seems to let us wash our hands of it. In other words, Charles Manson never murdered anyone, did he? That's a little harsh, Ben. It comes off as harsh, but torture is harsh. I always say, look, if torturing is required to win the war on terror, then when the war on terror is over, what has the torturing and the war on terror done to us? If Osama bin Laden is so evil, and I certainly do believe that he is, are we to come down to his level to beat him? You want to turn America into everything these bad people say we are? Keep doing what you're doing. And here's the part, ladies and gentlemen, that in my mind will not erase the stain, because I'm going to tell you how this is going to play out. This is going to play out that it's just going to go the way it goes, and then eventually this war on terror will peter out someday. I assume. I mean, if it doesn't, what does that mean? There's never going to be any peace treaty. We're not going to sign anything on a battleship with Osama bin Laden and say, hey, the war with al-Qaeda's over. So this thing either peters out at some point or continues forever. I'm assuming it's going to peter out at some point. At that time, you're going to start to see people say, well, you know, we overreacted, and eventually a generation will pass, and these people will die off, the people that are in charge of these decisions now, and then we will shed the crocodile tears the way we do for the Japanese Americans that were interned or the slavery situations. I mean, once the principles are dead, then we can feel bad about everything. You know why? Because there will never be any talk about punishing the people who did these things. But if you are going to preserve the myth of America and you're going to erase this stain on our country, and if you don't believe torture is a stain, I'm telling you, go read about torture. Go read the accounts of people who have lived through it. And realize that your tax dollars are paying for that right now. Feel a little dirty yet? And if you don't, I question a little bit about you. There are accounts you can go read. I remember one from a lady. I believe she was Colombian, but I don't recall. South American, Central American, a presumed leftist. And she was being tortured, and the torturer was on the phone. I believe it was two people in our government, country, intelligence services. And he would talk to them about this or that, smoking a cigarette, she said, during a break from torturing her in the most extreme, horrible ways. Then he would go back to the torturing. And she said the part that just destroyed her mind during this whole affair, I'll never forget this, was that at one point the torturer took a break from torturing her and took a call from his family. And his wife was basically asking him, you know, can you pick this up for dinner? Can you, you know, pick the kids up, do this? You know, I need something, you know, for this stew tonight. You know, go pick it up at the market on your way home.
And he took the call and then returned to the torturing. And she said the idea that this person lived a normal life and was not a monster in normal existence was just too much for her to handle. You go read accounts, ladies and gentlemen, of the people who go through torture and what they went through, and then ask yourself when it would ever be worth it. What would somebody have to do to this country to make you go, you know what, to heck with them? And not just that. If you're starting to get down that road where you go, hey, Dan, it doesn't matter. This is only happening to bad people. Well, this is the death penalty argument all over again, ladies and gentlemen. What's my problem with the death penalty? Is that we sometimes execute people that aren't guilty. What's the allowable failure rate for you in a death penalty case? How many innocent people out of 100 are you willing to sacrifice to keep the whole thing viable? 2, 5, 10, whatever it is. Same thing on torturing. How many people who haven't done anything are we torturing? And what's the allowable failure rate for your conscience on that? Can you win the war on terror without torturing? I think you can. I hope you can. If you can't, then you can't win the war on terror without being terroristic. In which case, well, it's a fool's game, isn't it? There's no way to win. You lose no matter what happens. The myth is gone at that point, isn't it? And here's what I was starting to get to with the whole Manson thing, folks, and the whole idea about how this is going to play out down the road. If you can't prosecute somebody for this, and I mean a high-level person, well, then they get away with it. Then this becomes one of those things where down the road we issue a congressional apology in 2035 to all those people that might have been renditioned under a previous regime, blah, blah. We're very sorry. We might even provide some financial compensation. No. You want to get serious about it? You prosecute people. And you don't do it the way the Italian courts are doing, although I think they're trying to do the best they can. You prosecute the president, and you prosecute the vice president, and you prosecute the people in the chain of command that approved of this. This is the whole issue, by the way, over the destruction of the CIA waterboarding tapes. When you read about the CIA's attitude about destroying the tapes, their attitude was, well, we didn't want our agents to be held accountable by some future regime that has a different idea about these things than the one that ordered the torturing. And from the CIA angle, I can see what they're talking about. You see, it's like these 26 guys that are on trial in Italy. Those guys are following orders. What are you going to do? Right? That's your job. The CIA wanted to protect the people who were doing the waterboarding by saying, look, the current president ordered this, and the people around him ordered this. We did our jobs. We don't want Barack Obama, as just one example, to become president next and then decide to prosecute these CIA agents for doing what the other president told them. Ladies and gentlemen, that's a completely legitimate fear that the CIA has there. What they're saying is the current administration's more radical on this than future administrations are likely to be. We don't want someone coming back and attacking us later for us doing what we were told. But what that implies, ladies and gentlemen, is that you have to hold accountable the people that ordered the stuff. Is the president guilty of war crimes? I don't know. Is torturing a war crime? Well, he didn't torture anyone, Dan. No, he just sent the people to be tortured to other countries to be tortured there because, well, if we did it in Kansas, there'd be no way to claim that we didn't have, well, I was going to say blood on our hands, Ben, but who knows what the heck we're torturing them with. Which brings me to another point, by the way. I'm going to get sick. I mean, physically sick. If I hear one more person try to say that the torturing is okay because the methods we're using aren't that bad. Turned on some talk show, it's a while back now. I think I've blotted it out from my head, Ben, where the guy was explaining that waterboarding's not that bad. What's the big deal? You ever seen anybody waterboarded? He said, it's no big deal, it's over, blah, 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 blah. Okay, let's just not play that game. They're not waterboarding people in Egypt. They're shocking them with electricity on the genitals while they're standing in water. How about that? That not so bad? Look, let me calm down for a minute. I know there's a lot of people listening to the show who have at one time or another in their life approved of this policy passively. You know, not been as upset as I am about it. And I don't want to make you out to be a bad person. I feel strongly that we just haven't thought this through, that this is one of those things that our judgment is clouded by the seriousness of the times. In the same way that I think that the people in the Franklin Roosevelt administration and the people that were running the Second World War put the Japanese Americans in internment camps because they were clouded by fear. We're clouded by fear. But to me, clouded by fear does not excuse what's going on. And what's going on is messing with the American myth. This is a stain, ladies and gentlemen, that is never going to go away. Don't you think that don't you think that 25, 30 years from now, this is going to be something you look back on with shame? And then here's your question. If it's going to be something you're going to look back on with shame and say, how did we do that? Or your children are going to say, how did our parents' generation do that? Well, stop it now. Stop it. Get out there and say, torturing is illegal. There's not a world body that sanctions it. It runs against every single international law. And if we were doing it in Kansas ourselves, at our version of the Lubyanka prison, you'd never get away with saying, hey, we're not doing anything wrong. It's because we're Mansoning this thing and saying, we don't torture anybody, but we send them to places that do, that is supposed to wash our hands of this. Folks, I don't use this term lightly. I live in a place, by the way, here in the Pacific Northwest. I live in what's left of the hippie capital of America. And they will call the president a war criminal all the time. You'll see bumper stickers and, you know, all kinds of terrible things. I don't use those terms lightly. But ladies and gentlemen, if the president approved the torturing of people, if the president encouraged it, if the president sent people to other countries knowing that they would be tortured when they get there, that's a war crime. How do you get away from that? And if you're one of those folks who believes that this torturing is somehow helping to keep us safe, then let me ask you this. Was the extreme rendition that we did in the Cold War, you know, providing lists of people for friendly governments who we gave tons of money to target and have disappear, was that okay? Did that protect us from the Russians in the 1960s, 1970s, and even the 1980s? And I think you know the answer. No. Throwing leftists out of aircraft in the South American dirty wars did nothing for our security. Let me tell you something. What we're doing now is going to fall into that same category. And if it's not doing anything for your security, then we're living right now with a stain that will stain our generation, well, forever. And what's more, we're not going to acknowledge it until the people that we would punish for this, in order to erase some of the guilt, well, we're going to wait till they're dead. We're going to wait till they're beyond the reach of law. Then we're going to admit that what we did was wrong, and we should never do it again, just like the Japanese Americans being interned. Well, I, for one, refuse to go that route. I don't think torturing helps us in the war on terror. I think it destroys the myth of America, the bar we should be striving towards. And I hate to say it, but like a lot of the radical people in this community that I live in, to me this is a war crime, and the president should be prosecuted. And if he shouldn't be prosecuted now, let me ask you, after this man dies in 30 years or so, you going to change your tune? And what do you think your children are going to think? I'd like my children to admire me, thank you very much. I'd like them to live in a country that doesn't do this, that chastises and sanctions other countries who do, not other countries that get money from us right now in order to help us out in the war on terror, when help us out is a euphemism for torturing in ways that we would never do ourselves because, well, that would be wrong.
Feel free to email the show at dan@dancarlin.com.
Visit the website at dancarlin.com and get involved with the community discussion group online.
Go to dancarlin.com for information on how to donate to the show.
We also want to thank you all for posting reviews on podcast sites and comments and blogs about the show. It's really helping.
Ben is sick again, ladies and gentlemen. That's right. Ben is sick. Ben has a bad case of Java overdose. That's right. He's had too much coffee. It's not Ben's fault, by the way. He's trying to keep up with me. And as a long-term coffee addict, I've never met a talk show host who wasn't, I can handle doses that would kill a normal human being, and Ben, not even quite being a normal human being, is finding himself, well, devastated trying to keep up the pace. Ben's got to be weaned off his addiction, switched to some sort of decaffeinated beverage, and that doesn't come cheap. We have a good way, though, you can help fund my, you know, producer decaffeination efforts. You can simply go to our website, click on the merchandise tab, and see if we have something you might want to own. Here's an example. We have all the old Common Sense shows. Shows 1 through 100 available on one DVD. You can even get, you know, the shows broken down into seasons if you want to. pick up some old Common Sense shows. See if you like show 5, show 10, show 25 as much as you like this one. And heck, if you didn't like this one, maybe you'll like the old shows more. In any case, the money will certainly, almost positively, some of the time, go to Ben's decaffeination efforts, and unfortunately, to my caffeination efforts. But hey, if you want a show, we do what we have to do. Stop shaking, Ben. Get to work. I know that first segment was a little bit rough. Wasn't it, Ben? A little bit rough? Maybe a little bit intense? I can't help it. That issue just drives me crazy, that whole torture morality thing. I always wonder what the president and the people around him, what are they, the most Christian administration in U.S. history, at least overtly? You always wonder that whole phrase about what would Jesus do when it comes to the whole torture thing. Ah, never mind. Enough of that. Don't want to go there, Ben, again. Time again for another edition of Riffin' on the News, though, and that's because I have about 6 stories here, all of which made the cut for today's show. And we have no other segment that will allow us to quickly skim over topics without going into the normal depth you appreciate on this program. But I think just including these ought to be interesting enough. Don't know which to start with either. Why don't we start with this one? All right, this first story is a confirmation of something that we told you was going to happen a long time ago. We told you that there were a bunch of social issues that a lot of the same groups are involved in, or a lot of the same people, that were going to eventually dovetail. You were going to find a way to connect this issue with that issue. Well, this one, my story is from The Telegraph, the British newspaper, but there were stories all over the planet. Well, this whole week. Mine is dated May 17, 2008. Patrick Sawyer wrote the piece. The headline is, "Fat people blamed for global warming." Quote, "As if they didn't already have enough problems on their hands, fat people are now being blamed for global warming. British scientists say they use up more fuel to transport them around, and the amount of food they eat requires more energy to produce than the food consumed by those on smaller diets." The story says, "According to a team at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, this adds to food shortages and higher energy prices." Researcher Phil Edwards said, quote, "We are all becoming heavier, and it is a global responsibility. Obesity is a key part of the big picture," end quote. See, folks, what this does is take a problem that was national in nature. In the United States, the way that this whole thing is framed is that fat people are costing us all money. I'm not a fat person, but I have a wallet, and the heavier people are taking money out of my wallet, so the argument goes that we need to crack down on fat people because, well, they have no right to take from my wallet via, you know, I'm not fat, you're fat, why should I pay for your health problems and all that come with it? But see, that's not international in scope. We told you a long time ago that these issues were going to eventually dovetail. Now the people in India have a reason to care about Americans being overweight. That's what this story does. This story takes people whose wallets are not connected currently to obese people and connects it to them. What that scientist essentially said was that the whole world is connected and a fat person in the United States has adverse effects on the rest of the planet. Now, let's just say that this is being roundly criticized, even though this appeared in a respectable medical journal, because people realize this goes too far. Even if it's true, it goes too far. Because, you know, what are the ramifications? Fat people are destroying the planet. What are you going to do? In any case, I have nothing to say about this except that we told you this would happen. That one way or another, we all do something that costs each other money. And if you believe these groups, destroys the planet. So what are we going to do? Anyway, that's not very deep, Ben, is it? I really had no good solutions there. I just wanted you to know that we told you that eventually the global warming fat police thing was going to dovetail, and it is. This next story, May 17, 2008, an Associated Foreign Press piece, headline, "Obama Camp Spies Endgame in Oregon." And of course, that's where the show hails from, Oregon. Obama, by the way, has been all over Oregon, and I have been contacting his campaign practically daily, asking for 10 minutes of the man's time on this podcast. He's been speaking to groups of people smaller, much smaller than this audience, and so is Bill Clinton, by the way, Ben, and I can't get him on this show either. He's talking to like five people in an outhouse in, you know, Southern Oregon, and I can't get him on this show. In any case, all the Obama campaign people have been doing is turning over my media contact information to their door-to-door canvassers, and I keep getting phone calls on my business line saying, will you go door-to-door for Obama? And I have to tell them every time, no, I want him to come on the show. In any case, can't get him on the show. He had a speech in Portland yesterday that had about 15 million people, 15 million people in the audience, or 125 million people in the audience, whatever it was. But Obama said something yesterday, no, May 17th, so 2 days ago, that upset me. You know, we did a show recently about the debate questions we wish we could ask these candidates, the, you know, the hidden parts of their agendas that we want to know about, but you never get that deep into the story. Well, in the speech that Obama made here in Oregon, he alluded to one of those things that I would like to know a little bit more about. Of course, in the speech, there's no follow-up questions. I'm cutting way into the middle of the piece because the piece was about, you know, the electoral returns in Oregon and how important Oregon is and, you know, blah, blah, blah. Let me quote from about two-thirds down into the piece, though, and you'll see one of those questions that I desperately want answered, and I have a feeling we're not going to get it answered until the man's president. Quote, pitching his message to Oregon's environmentally conscious voters, Obama called on the United States to lead by example on global warming and develop new technologies at home which could be exported to developing countries. Quote, we can't drive our SUVs and eat as much as we want and keep our homes on 72 degrees at all times and then just expect that other countries are going to say, okay, Obama said. That's not leadership. That's not going to happen. End quote. Okay, what's the follow-up question, folks? Well, the follow-up question is, now how are you going to do this? If Americans want to drive SUVs, want to eat what they want, and want to have their homes at 72 degrees, Mr. President, what is your plan to get them to not do what it is they want to do? And that leads you to the obvious point, which is Barack Obama's talking about, in one way or another, discouraging Americans from doing what they want to do. Now, this might be the responsible position to have. I'm not saying it's not. But isn't that worth a follow-up question? Did you hear that at any of the 157,000 debates we had with this guy and the mainstream media? I want an answer to that question. How are you going to make Americans stop doing what they want to do? In any case, there you go. Riffing on the news. Barack Obama says something that we want a follow-up question for. This one's an interesting story. This one has to do with cluster bombs. You know what a cluster bomb is? Cluster bomb is something that, I'm trying to think when the first cluster bombs were used, Ben. I want to say, depends on what you call a cluster bomb. Is a canister round a cluster bomb? Yeah, canister rounds in the Second World War. Vietnam, we certainly were using cluster bombs, and after Vietnam. A cluster bomb is a big bomb that has a bunch of little bomblets in it. And generally what happens is either a plane will drop this thing or an artillery shell will shoot this thing and scatter these bomblets all over the place. Now, the same folks that were upset about landmines are upset about cluster bombs. And in the same way they tried to get international groups to come together and ban landmines and whatnot, they're trying to get the same thing to happen with cluster bombs. There's a conference going on in Ireland, in Dublin, this week, actually. That the story I'm looking at, it's a BBC News piece by Sanjita Miska, I believe that's her name. It says the UK government is to join more than 100 nations in Dublin this week for talks that campaigners believe could lead to the most significant disarmament treaty for a decade. Nonsense is all I have to say about that. Folks, listen, these folks are well-intentioned, these arms control people. And we've had them for, well, at least 150 years. We may have always had arms control people. The problem is that they go at these things from the totally wrong way of looking at it. Let me explain what I mean. These people want peace and nonviolence, which is a wonderful goal. But when you're talking about reforming military hardware, it colors your glasses. You know, your rose-colored glasses get in the way. See, let's just take landmines as a wonderful example. And of course, you know what the problem is with all these things, right, folks? The reason that they had problems, these same people with landmines, and the reason they have problems with cluster munitions is because those weapons stay dangerous long after their use is through. You know, you put a landmine in the ground during the war, the war's over, the landmine's still there, and a kid walks on it 10 years later and becomes another casualty of a long-done war. We all understand that. That's a problem. But what these folks who want peace and nonviolence, as I said, a great goal, try to do is ban the weapon, completely ignoring the fact that a lot of these weapons are extremely valuable and extremely useful for the military. Landmines are a perfect example. There is nothing that does what a landmine does. From a tactical standpoint and a strategic standpoint, I mean, let's put it this way. If our country was invaded today, you would pray for landmines. They're a wonderful defensive weapon. What you basically have is something that you could put on the ground, walk away, and it will do its job while you're gone. Unfortunately, doing its job while you're gone might kill a 10-year-old kid 10 years after the war. If these groups were not so intent on, you know, banning weapons outright, they might actually stand a chance of achieving their goal. See, they're mad that the British government doesn't want to jump on board with this cluster bomb prohibition, just like the U.S. doesn't. Well, they don't want to because these cluster bombs are really valuable to them. And let's understand something. Battlefields, when the battle is over, are always dangerous, always full of stuff that will hurt civilians and people. There's a great book, if you're really interested in this subject, you can go pick up. It's called Aftermath, The Remnants of War, by a guy named Donovan Webster. And the whole first part of the book is about the cleanup efforts that still continue, you know, at a great pace today in France, from munitions that were shot off during the First World War. I'm convinced that the vast majority of people have no idea how much cleanup is still going on. The French government estimates that there are more than 12 million unburied, unexploded shells in the area of France that was heavily bombarded during the First World War. Tons and tons of this stuff are picked up every year in France and disposed of. People die all the time. I think there were, you know, 20 people died in 1991 or something, 100 people injured. I mean, you know, people are dying in France from munitions shot off in 1914. There's whole areas of the country that are still off limits. So when people single out landmines or single out cluster bombs, just understand something. War leaves behind dangerous leftovers. You're not going to stop war, and you're not going to stop the use of weapons that are effective and useful to the militaries. What's more, if you were invaded, you wouldn't want to. But you might, you just might, be able to convince, you know, countries to put a lot of money and effort into making sure that when the munitions, you know, life is over and we don't need them anymore, they stop hurting people. You got to take off, though, your anti-war rose-colored glasses to be able to do that sometimes. I remember having this discussion during Princess Diana's big push a while back. Well, it's got to be a while back now, doesn't it, Ben? Princess Diana's a while back now, but she was pushing for landmine banning, and there was a lot of criticism against the United States government for not jumping on board, and that was the Clinton administration, Ben, except that they realized how important landmines were. What the group should have been doing was pushing for new technological rules, or new rules governing technology, that would say, look, if you're going to make landmines, you have to make sure that they will become inert after a certain period of time. You can't have these weapons polluting, you know, landscapes 20 years after the conflict is over. That's a common sense way to deal with that problem. The reason that that approach wasn't taken is these groups want, you know, war gone. They want munitions gone. They want weapons gone. This is the same sort of attitude that propelled the people who banned or tried to ban things like poison gas, who wanted to ban nuclear weapons, who wanted to ban, you know, battleship construction. I mean, dumb bullets, it goes all the way back. They are successful when they choose weapon systems that are not vitally important. When you choose weapon systems that are really effective, you have to take a different tack. You have to understand that the militaries of the world need these things, and you have to say, okay, even though I wish for a nonviolent world, I realize landmines have a place in the, you know, military arsenals. So let's make landmines that don't kill kids 10 years from now. This story is another example, though, of, you know, not seeing the forest for the trees. If these groups could be, well, I guess, what do you want them to say, Ben? I mean, it's nice to have folks who want peace. At the same time, if you want to actually achieve your goals, realize that the militaries of the world want cluster bombs, need landmines. So figure out a way to keep those things from killing the people you don't want them to kill long after the conflict you were killing people is over with. That makes sense? Got another one, though, and this one I'm going to quote extensively. This is a piece by Robert Samuelson, who is one of my favorite columnists in the U.S. He's a writer who specializes in economic affairs, but what I like about him is He's the absolute definition of common sense. He's also nonpartisan. He's a guy I'd like to have on the show, Ben. We need to get a guest booker on this show. I mean, you saw how well I did with getting Barack Obama and Bill Clinton on this show. We need somebody who's either a better arm twister or a better rear-end kisser or something. Get some of these people on board. I'd love to have Robert Samuelson on the show. Anyway, Samuelson has a piece, appeared in my local paper Wednesday, May 14th, 2008, and it's a piece on the campaign, you know, the presidential campaign, and what these, you know, people campaigning for the top job aren't telling you and why they're not telling you what they're not telling you. Samuelson is saying that McCain, Hillary Clinton, and Barack Obama are not telling you, you know, the real truth because they won't get elected if they do. And he actually has a little line in the piece about what could you find out about these candidates if you gave them a truth serum. And that reminded me of a post on our discussion board that one of you, one of the listeners, made. It was on the thread about the history show we recently did, the Blitz one, about, you know, who would you like to give a breathalyzer test to in history? And most people, like me, were answering, you know, Ivan the Terrible, all these people from the past. And one of the listeners, I wish I could remember his name right now, said, I'd like a truth serum given to our candidates right now when they're speaking to the public on the TV. Let's really find out what those guys would say, which is a wonderful thought if you, you know, cast the image in your head of what that might look like. In any case, that's kind of what Samuelson says. He says, if you gave him a truth serum, here's what all your candidates would say. This is where I'm going to quote at length. Samuelson writes from the middle of the piece, quote, there's a vast gap between the country's problems and the candidates' agendas and rhetoric. The candidates dissemble because they believe Americans don't want the truth. It would be too upsetting. They're probably right. Let's imagine, Samuelson writes, what a candidate inoculated with a truth serum might say. This gauges the distance between what Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and John McCain are saying and what they should be saying. He says, here's the abbreviated stump speech on the truth serum. Quote, fellow Americans, I know you worry about the economy, so do I. But frankly, if you elect me, I won't do much about it. It's a $14 trillion economy. Every 3 months, 7 million Americans change jobs. Presidents aren't powerful enough to steer this colossus. Sure, we can pass stimulus programs, but if we overdo it, as we did in the 1970s, we will make the economy worse. Believe me, presidents would prevent recessions if they could. What we can do is preserve an economic climate that favors long-term growth. That means holding down the tax burden to maintain incentives for work and investments. We're already running a $400 billion deficit or so. Some broad-based tax increases may be needed. This will disappoint conservatives who think no one should pay taxes and liberals who think that only rich people should pay them. But we must also cut spending because unless we do, the future tax increases will be crushing. Of necessity, spending cuts should focus on Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. These programs are projected to grow from about 45% of the present budget to 70% of the budget over the next couple of decades. Paying for that exclusively with taxes would be devastating. Paying exclusively by cutting other programs would gut vital government services. I admit that raising eligibility ages for baby boomers and cutting some benefits are unfair. People should have received more warning, but our politicians have so dawdled that there's no warning time left. We've also dawdled on energy. No one likes $125 for a barrel of oil. Last year, we paid an average price of $64 a barrel for imports. Some blame the oil companies, but the truth is we're all to blame. Americans like cheap gasoline and big vehicles. Nothing was done to dampen consumption. Meanwhile, Congress restricted new oil and gas exploration on environmental grounds. So demand rose and supply fell. In 1985, we imported 4 million barrels of oil a day. Now that's 12 million. Energy independence is a fraud. We simply use too much foreign oil. All we can do is limit our dependence by shifting to more efficient vehicles and increasing domestic production. But these measures will take years and have only modest effects. The same is true of global warming. Without major technological breakthroughs, making big cuts in greenhouse gases will be impossible. Finally, let's discuss poverty. Everyone is against it, but hardly anyone admits that most of the increase in the past 15 years reflects immigration, new immigrants or children of recent immigrants. Unless we stop poor people from coming across our southern border, legally and illegally, we won't reduce poverty. Period. That doesn't mean we should try to expel the 12 million illegal immigrants already here, an impossible and morally dubious task. Many families have been here for years. Many have American children. We need a pragmatic accommodation. Assimilate most people now, here. Shift future immigration to the highly skilled. Vote for me. I'll tell you the truth. End quote. Sorry for that long quote, but isn't that guy fabulous? He's a fabulous writer. We need a whole slew of guest bookers for this show, Ben. And if you want to be one of them, get me Robert Samuelson. That'll be your test. And finally, the last story, just to bring the whole show full circle, I guess you could say, Ben. You know, put a nice little ribbon on the end of it. Connect the dots. Both these stories were in my local paper today, by the way. That would be Monday, May 19th, 2008. The first is about President Bush and his appearance in the Middle East. He was talking to the Arab leaders. The headline in my local paper, it's a New York Times story, says, Bush presents Arab leaders with to-do list. And the subheadline is, in a speech to the World Economic Forum in Egypt, the president talks about women and democracy. And it's a piece about President Bush explaining how the Middle East needs to transform itself, move into modernity and all these kind of things, right? And the U.S. is going to push to help, and in the places we can, we're going to force change and all this kind of stuff. But in the very same story is this piece, Dateline, Kabul, Afghanistan, quote, an Afghan journalism student sentenced to death for insulting Islam, denied the charges before an appeals court Sunday, saying he only confessed to questioning the religion's treatment of women because he was tortured. During an hour-long hearing, a judge read aloud the transcript of January 22nd proceedings against 24-year-old Saeed Parez Kambakish at the primary court in the northern Balkh province. It was the first time the public and the media heard the full details from the closed-door trial, which highlights the influence of conservative religious attitudes in post-Taliban Afghanistan's still young justice system. The transcript said that the accused disrupted classes at Balkh University by asking questions about women's rights under Islam. It also said that he distributed an article about the subject and wrote an additional three paragraphs for the piece. Did you catch that, folks? This guy's been sentenced to death for bringing up a question in college about Islam's treatment of women. Not a statement, a question. He claims, you know, that's funny, Ben. In this country, you'd say, well, I did it for women's rights and I stand by what I said. He said that he did it, the only reason he admitted it was because he was tortured. So not only is the part of the trial farcical that says that this guy should be put to death for, you know, questioning Islam's treatment of women, but he claims he didn't even do it, that he was tortured to admit it. Folks, President Bush is there telling these Arab regimes that they have to reform, regimes we have very little control over, but the regime we have almost total control over, the one in Afghanistan that we put into power, is going to execute a 24-year-old, if they have their way, I'm sure we'll arm twist them now, Ben, for just questioning whether women aren't treated well in Islamic societies. And what's more, he claims he didn't even do that, but he was tortured to admit it. I mean, do you see how absurd that is? Do you see how maybe ridiculous it is to go try to bring that part of the world up to the level that we think they should be up to? Half that population is women. Every man in that society keeping women down has a mother that they love. We'd be better off letting those people have their own revolution and figure this all out for themselves. And the number one thing to do is to let them live a little bit under these kinds of rules that they seem to like so much, and then let the natural course of nature happen. I got news for you, ladies and gentlemen, and I've said it before. The best answer to radical Islam is to let the people in that region have some of it. It was the reason communism fell in the Soviet Union. Give them a little freedom. Nobody wants communism anymore. Give the people in the Islamic Middle East a little hard line Islam, and we're going to have a whole bunch of friends all of a sudden. And we could use a few in the region, don't you think, Ben? Time to stop telling them what to do. Let them stew in the soup for a little while and stand by the phone ready for when they call. If you have a different opinion, I'd love to hear from you. Dan at dancarlin.com is the way to get a hold of us. Why don't you head on over to the website, see the interesting people and the interesting discussions we have there, which I bring up on the show often. Ben, Java Overdose, as we told you earlier. You want to help him out? Buck a Show donations always work. Podcast Alley, votes, iTunes reviews, you know the drill. This show came out relatively quick, didn't it, Ben? So maybe 4, 5, 7, 8, 19 days, we're going to have another one of these audio commentaries for you. Until that time, thank you for everything, folks, and I'll leave you with that.
A Buck a Show. It's all we ask. It's about the cost of 5 chicken nuggets without an extra package of honey mustard sauce.
Don't forget to vote for Common Sense with Dan Carlin on PodcastAlley.com.
We also want to thank you all for posting reviews on podcast sites and comments and blogs about the show. It's really helping.